back to... Two pizzas, a Goodfella's stone-baked pepperoni pizza costing £3 at Tesco, and Aldi's Which Best by Carlos stone-baked pepperoni pizza costing just £1.39. So where can you save over 50% on your pizza?
Can't top that.
Time's up, you're right. Aldi's the answer. So come on down to Aldi, which cheapest supermarket of the year. Other supermarkets may sell own brand products at different prices. For full details, see aldi.co.uk/swap.
V1. Pull up. Pull up. Pull up. Terrain. Terrain. Pull up. Terrain.
Welcome to the Flight Safety Detectives. Hosts John Golia and Greg Fife, two of the world's most respected aviation safety experts, talk all things related to aviation and aerospace. This podcast and the Flight Safety Detectives YouTube channel are brought to you by the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, PAMA, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance and your one stop for all general aviation insurance needs. Get a customized quote at avemco.com or give them a call at 888-879-0389. Tell them you're a listener of the show and receive a 5% discount. Now it's time to buckle up because it's wheels up for the latest episode of Flight Safety Detectives.
Well, hello, John. It's another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. I'm glad to see that you made it back home to Boston. We were together in Nashville and doing some proactive safety work, which we'll talk about later at the end of the show. But I want to get us right into a couple of things. One, we're going to talk about a couple of recent accidents that occurred that are still in the news because they are that recent. And then I want to talk a little bit about some of the emails that we've received on some of our previous shows, especially the last two shows. So without further ado, I want to talk about a Cessna TU-206. It's a Turbo 206 that was flying pipeline patrol down in Texas. One of the pilots was a 55-year-old gentleman, and there was a young lady, commercials. Certificated pilot also in the airplane. At this point, it's unclear as to what the relationship was with the two pilots, whether one was training the other one, or they typically fly two pilots. Of course, that'll be something that the NTSB will be looking into amongst a number of other things. But in looking at just the basic facts, because there isn't a lot of information out, and the NTSB hasn't really published a prelim on the accident yet, but looks like they were flying pipeline patrol. And anybody that's done that knows that you're flying low, you're bobbing in and out, weaving around things. You're always looking for obstructions and obstacles and things like that that you got to avoid. And I don't know about you, John, but in looking at the pictures, it's quite evident they either hit something, which then forced the airplane or pitched the airplane into a pretty steep nose low attitude, right wing low, because it looks like the airplane struck the ground right wing low, nose low, which totally shoved the prop, the engine, well back into the firewall, into the occupiable space of the airplane, or they were flying low and slow and got too slow and possibly stalled the airplane. So again, these are the things that the board's going to have to ferret out in their investigation, as well as the operational issues. And then, as we've always talked about, the mechanical issues, ruling either them in or out in this particular event.
Yeah, piston engines and airplanes going slow. It's not like a jet; they can accelerate pretty quickly, but you got to anticipate it a little bit. And you know, with your head out the window, not paying attention to your speed, that's a dangerous situation.
Yep, especially if you're having to bank around things, because as we know. As you get into a bank turn, the stall speed goes up. And so you really have to have a high level of operational discipline, especially when it comes to the airspeed and making sure that you don't get yourself into a position. It'll be interesting. I mean, the pictures clearly show that it looks like the flaps were up. And if, again, you're flying slow, you really want to have some flaps down. So without speculating a whole lot, just looking at pictures, the NTSB, you know, probably will have this one figured out, or at least have a lot of information to put out in the prelim once it does come out. But anytime you're flying pipeline, power line patrol, things like that, the operational issues seem to be very predominant in this particular instance. The airplane crashed in an open field. If they had a mechanical problem, they lost the engine, they were trying to glide to an open field, that could be a scenario as well that the NTSB will have to be looking at.
Yeah, you know, and one thing that came into my mind as I read the narrative was who was flying.
Yeah.
Two pilots on board, and they're, who's looking out the window? Maybe they were both looking out the window, thinking the other person was flying.
Yeah.
Communications, you got it. Who's flying?
And we've talked about that as far as transference of control and things like that, to understand who, in fact, is actually manipulating the controls and who has the ability to monitor either what's going on in the cockpit or outside the airplane. So these are all questions that the NTSB should be asking and hopefully looking for answers. And when we've dissected the process of accident investigation in this particular instance, there was no post-crash fire. So, of course, fuel loads are always a question to make sure that they did, in fact, have fuel on the airplane. But I always examine the autopsies because I learned a lot from autopsy reports about the dynamics of the impact itself. And you can tell a lot, not only from the physical evidence in the airplane, the control yokes especially, or the throttle controls, but from the damage to the victims, you can actually tell whether or not someone had their hands on the controls, whether it's the control yoke or the rudder pedals, by looking at the type of brakes, bone brakes that someone might have, the marks. And then, of course, you're always looking for the torso marks to make sure that they were wearing seatbelts, shoulder harnesses, things like that.
You know, no fire does call into question what the status of fuel was. And why were they landing at the other airport 30 minutes away, or 30 miles, I forget what it said. You know, are we chasing cheap fuel prices?
Yeah, especially right now. I just heard from a friend of mine that he was flying a trip. He flies a G450 and a 550. They're paying $12 a gallon for Jet A. It was like, it's out of control now. And that's going to really curtail some flying. The more mandatory type flying with emergency EMS and things like that, I don't think it's going to scale back much. And of course, the airlines have their ways of hedging fuel and holding the price down a bit. But when you look at the price of Jet A and Avgas, that could be a factor with, like you said, John, people chasing cheap fuel prices. So now they're flying the up and down type flights that those are more risky that I've seen in the past, because not only are you kicking the tires, lighting the fire, let's rock and roll, get up. But as soon as you get up, you're already on your way down. And that's a perfect opportunity, not only to miss things on a pre-flight, but it's a perfect opportunity to miss things as you prepare to land, because you're just getting through an after takeoff checklist. There is no cruise. You're basically up and then putting it down. I'm working an accident right now, a similar situation where pilot took off with an airplane right out of maintenance. It was only going 10 miles to the next airport. So by the time he got up, he was already starting on the way down into the traffic pattern and had a problem. So these are the kinds of things that is, from an investigative standpoint, why it doesn't sound like much and that has really nothing to do. It does, because it sets up a storyline. It sets up a sequence of events. And now you have to ferret out fact from fiction to see how much influence some of these things may or may not have on the operation of the airplane and, of course, the decision-making by the pilots.
You know, as I read this report, and it goes into detail on the young lady that was flying, and I felt really bad for her. She was only 27 years old. She had a ton of experience. She had a bright, bright future ahead of her in aviation, and it's gone. I hope it's not from something that was really stupid.
Yeah, and transitioning or segueing from that accident to another young lady who was involved in a more recent accident in Idaho, flying a Cessna 208 Grand Caravan. She was moving some cargo for UPS. It was a UPS contract hauler. She too had been flying for better than 10 years. And being 30 years old, you know that these are the stepping stone type aircraft pathways. That is, she's flying cargo, building up her time. I guess her big dream was, of course, to go to a major. And so, of course, they're building time. And you know, one of the things that I noticed in this accident, she's on final approach. She's shooting a GPS approach to a smaller airport in Idaho that is handling all of the cargo feeders, if you will. And the weather wasn't optimum. It was more at minimums. And there's a lot of speculation out there when you start reading Catherine's report and all the people that are chiming in about what may have transpired. But she's shooting an instrument approach, a GPS approach. And according to FlightAware data, it looks like she had executed the approach twice. The first time she abandoned the approach right at about minimums or a little above. The second time, it looks like she was below minimums and below the elevation that you'd expect. The aircraft ended up hitting some object. There's a bunch of discussion on the internet as to whether or not she hit a 60-foot smokestack at a potato processing plant. At some point up or down on that smokestack, there's an associated stairway that shows damage. Again, the NTSB hasn't put out a prelim yet, so we really don't know what's fact and fiction, other than the fact that on the approach, she struck something. The airplane ended up on the roof, inverted, with the wings significantly damaged on top of this potato processing plant. Of course, she ended up receiving fatal injuries. And when you start looking at the sequence of events of this particular accident, and I always look at the influences on these types of operations, because I've seen them so many times, I've investigated a number of them. And when you look at these feeder carriers who are on contract to the UPSs and the FedExes of the world, I always look at the contract requirements, because I have found in the past that time pressures influence bad decision making, because these packages have to be on schedule. That's how we get these one-day deliveries and things like that, is the packages that are on an aircraft, these flights that are scheduled to move these packages, must be at a destination at a certain time, so that there is no ripple effect of having package delays and things like that, because these packages are being picked up or delivered on a schedule. And that has influenced in a number of accidents that I've investigated in the past, has influenced bad decision-making. Got to accomplish the mission, got to get it in there, got to be there, because it's costly in contract terms, because there are monetary penalties. And if you have so many penalties, Big Brother will probably cancel that contract. So there's a lot of outside influences as to why pilots may try to do things with these types of flights that you wouldn't normally see. And that should be one primary aspect of the NTSB's investigation, is looking at on-time performance. There was apparently, based on some internet traffic about this accident, there was another aircraft, or at least another flight, that had diverted to a different airport because of the weather. So all of these things are going to come into play with regard to why or why not this young lady continued to try and shoot this approach multiple times rather than diverting to another airport. You mentioned, John, when we were talking off air, that the weather, you know, again, the weather is going to be one of those things where it's very subjective when it comes to pilots and the operation of an airplane. If the weather is down to minimums, some people go, well, hey, it was down to minimums. You can still shoot the approach. Yes, you can. But are there influences that, yeah, the weather is at minimum, but you know that the airport's just right there. And, you know, do you squeak down another 50 feet, seeing if you can catch a peek of the runway environment to continue the approach? Because the last thing you want to have to do is abandon it.
Yeah. And considering this was her home airport, and that's another factor that sometimes enters into people's minds, that, you know, they know where everything is and they think they know their position, and they try for that extra 50 feet to try to sneak it in. So we'll have to wait and see where that goes. And, you know, Greg, as I prepared some of these cases for this podcast and our others, over the last couple of years, something has jumped out for me. And that is, you know, we've talked for years in this industry about the Dr. Killers, the Piper Malibus, and the other airplanes where people that have the means buy these high-performance airplanes and go crash them. But you know what? Over the last year, there have been a lot of accidents with doctors. As it is that all the doctors have been so wrapped up tight with all the medical problems that we've had in this country with COVID and all the rest of it, that they're not flying and because they're not involved in the accidents. They just don't show up. I'm going to go through it again.
Yeah.
Specifically for that, for every one of them. But I it's something that jumped out on me.
And you know, in a related discussion with that, and it relates to this accident, and that is this airplane has a Garmin 1000. It will provide, hopefully, a lot of information to the NTSB if it was equipped with the little SD cards to record the data. I use them all the time in accident investigation to put together. They're basically a poor man's flight data recorder, if you will. And so you can get a lot of operational information from those types of systems to try and put the storyline together. But automation also in general aviation, I've seen the uptick, and that's why we've had this discussion, John. It's not necessarily the airplane anymore. It's not the Malibus. It's not the Bonanzas. It's not the Beach Barons. As an airplane, it's the automation that's in those airplanes, because what pilots tend to lack in their own personal skills, abilities, knowledge, and confidence, they transfer that into the airplane, because with all that automation up front, they have TAWS, so they can see the ground, basically. They can see rising terrain. They can see obstructions. They have, of course, weather. So now you have XM weather or ADS-B data coming up to the airplane. You have traffic, so I know where everybody else is. With all of those kinds of things, and then, of course, you combine that with the GPS, that pretty magenta line that you point and shoot, you know, as long as you keep that little airplane symbol on that magenta line, whether you're hand flying the airplane or you got the autopilot on, pilots tend to put themselves in a position of decision making that's further into a bad situation than they would have normally. And I've seen this with my own flying, and that is when, you know, when I learned to fly and instrument flying, you know, those of us that can relate to the old six packs, I still think to this day that is the way to teach every new instrument pilot. Why? Because it forces them to make mental models to see what it is that they're doing, and it forces you into decision making further back to give you a little more margin than waiting till you're in a bad situation and then trying to figure it out on the fly after you've already committed yourself a little further than you probably wanted to. So, I mean, these are the human factors elements that I see in a lot of accidents. I've discussed it on a variety of shows and, in, of course, this show. And I've also had to write about it as an expert witness in trying to explain it. And it's not easily explained, especially when the person is no longer with us. But there are a lot of circumstances, John, where you can line up those pieces of Swiss cheese, if you will, that Dr. Reasons has talked about and ingrained in everybody in acts investigation and human factors discussions, that it's the Swiss cheese model. You know, all those pieces of Swiss cheese line up and you have all the perfect circles. And next thing you know, bad things are starting to happen. And you know, that's what we're seeing in these types of accidents. And I wish the NTSB would get a little more into those human factors elements. They got people on staff to help them do it, because maybe that will help enhance aviation safety on the general aviation side of the house.
Yeah, I wish they would do a lot more work on the general aviation side of the house. You know, as you were going through the chain of events that you would look at, the chain of circumstances maybe, that you would look at in an investigation, I'm thinking about a number of emails that we've gotten from people who still just focus on one piece of it. And they don't take the time to mentally grasp this all these events that come together in sequence to make an accident.
Yep.
And we'll talk about that with a couple of the emails that we've selected to talk about. But, you know, folks out there, accidents are a chain of events. We've heard it a million times. I hear many of our people mention it in the podcast, but then the next sentence is focused down into the weeds and they discounted all the other pieces that lead up to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the narrative that the news industry created over the two Boeing accidents is a perfect example. And why don't we get into that multiple emails we have from folks that have disregarded all of that. You know, and the first one, I'd like to talk about Faulkner, because somebody criticized me in one of the emails.
Yep.
About Faulkner. Now, he was charged.
Well, hold on a second. Let's set people up if they haven't heard it. We had a show where we brought on Jeffrey Thomas. He is an award-winning journalist. He is down under. He lives in Perth. He puts out a lot of great content with regard to not only Boeing, but Airbus and the aviation industry as a whole. And he is very well respected. You see him quite a bit. And he was on almost every day when MH370 happened, because he had his finger on the pulse of what was going on with the Australian investigative team, of course, Malaysia and others. And so we had him on the show and we had a very open and frank discussion about the two MAX accidents and what was going on with Boeing with regard to not only those accidents, but just Boeing as a whole and the relationship between Boeing and the FAA and other parts of the industry. And you and I, John, have dissected these MAX accidents. We've done Lion Air to the nth degree, where we were waiting for the final Ethiopian report, which I'm now satisfied it's never going to come. So you and I are working off the kind of final report that the Ethiopians put out. But when you dissect the pure facts, conditions, and circumstances of just those accidents, just the accidents, not this sexy story relationship between Boeing and the FAA that has really, you know, circulated around the world, and that became the focus. But when you look at the facts, conditions, and circumstances of each of these two accidents, I was critical of the pilots. I was critical of the organization, the airline. And I took a little bit of heat because they said, you always blame the pilots. I'm a pilot. The last thing I want to do is blame a pilot. But again, like you were just talking about, John, you have got to separate, and a lot of our audience tends to get, you know, they focus on factoids. And we've talked about, you build a storyline around a factoid, it's going to be wrong. And that's what we try not to do. You and I have done it for a very long time. We look at the big scope. And in our discussion with Jeffrey, he even agreed. And when we were critical of this Netflix show, we presented the facts that weren't presented by the Netflix show the backstories, if you will, about those MAX accidents. We were very in agreement, if you will, with the downfall of Boeing in the second part of that show and what led to their downfall and the acquisition of McDonnell Douglas and the assets and the people and the attitudes. And so, of course, we had somebody write in saying that, it was a great show, except, and you took the heat for some of it. And Mark Faulkner, who was one of the production test pilots, came under fire a couple of years ago as being the linchpin, if you will, for all of this MAX stuff. And a lot of us in the industry shook our heads saying that can't be possible. He's just mid-level in management. There are a lot of people above him. So why is he taking the heat for it?
Nobody wants to hear that believes that Faulkner had a role in there, wants to hear they took him to court. The U.S. government took him to court. And I think the court hearing went almost 2 weeks, and the jury only took 2 hours to say that he wasn't guilty.
Yeah.
And they got to hear all the facts, all right, probably stuff that we didn't even pick up on because it was hidden inside either Boeing documents that are proprietary or whatever. But the jury heard it all, and they found him not guilty. So that's a very telling comment. But I'd like to go back to the Indonesian accident. You know, if we don't blame the pilots, I blame more than one pilot for that.
Oh, yeah.
And I blame a bunch of my fellow mechanics. That airplane came out of China, out of Beijing, with a angle of attack transducer that wasn't working properly. And they carried that for the accident occurred 30 days later. They carried it for 29 days. Maintenance touched the airplane repeatedly in those 29 days, and they continued to release it. And I have said on TV, I've said it in a lot of places, that I don't know a mechanic in this country that works for an airline that would have released that airplane.
Yeah.
They just would not have happened. You might have taken the chance to get it out of Beijing to get it back to home base, but it would have ended right there. They would not have taken it any further. But not only were they maintenance nursing this on, they were actually talking to the pilots about carrying this airplane.
And the pilots did, unfortunately.
The pilots did. And I really would hang out to dry the pilots of this airplane the day before the accident, because they flew it all day with a damn stick shaker just shaking for the entire flight. Just imagine, as a pilot, those of you that are listening to the pilots, you're sitting there with your hands on the control column, and the whole way is like,
hey. For 2 hours.
Right, 2 hours, having that thing go off. And then you bring it into the maintenance station, and you don't write it up.
Yep.
Not in the logbook. There's no indication that they told maintenance that they had that problem. So you talk about hiding a critical defect in the airplane. I mean, really. And that's the lead up into these pilots that come to work and don't know any of that past stuff and take an airplane that's sick and go crash it.
And that's why, John, when we talk about the sequence of events starts well before the accident. And whether it's the day before, an hour before, or in this case, 30 days before, where you start looking at the lineage of what was going on with that airplane and its maintenance history, you see that it was being carried around the system. And every mechanic that touched it returned it to service, including the guys out of Bali, who the mechanics actually talked the pilots into flying this airplane back to Jakarta because they couldn't fix it in Bali. So they said, hey, just get this airplane back to Jakarta. They'll fix it at the base. And these guys, instead of saying not only no, but hell no, they took the airplane. And so, you know, with Mark and what happened with him, a lot of people didn't bother to do the research. They saw the front side story, and we're always talking about the backside. We're always talking about what's in the shadows. When you look at what Mark was talking about through these emails, because it was his emails that were really the center focal point of what was coming down on him. Those emails, as we were briefed and as we understand it, and as you read them, if you really read them, it had nothing to do with the physical airplane itself. This airplane wasn't doing all the things that Mark said in these emails in the air, not in any way, shape, or form. He was talking about the engineering simulator and the fact that the data that they were pumping into it was causing the simulator to do things that it shouldn't be doing, that made the airplane really uncontrollable in the simulator, not in the airplane. But people wanted to make a sexy story out of it. And they basically said, look at all these emails that said that this airplane couldn't fly. It was this, that, and the other, and Mark's flying. It was the simulator. And I'm sure that amongst all of the facts that the jury got, that was the explanation and the interpretation. And of course, the proof that, hey, look, this wasn't happening with the airplane. This was happening in a simulator. And there is a difference for those that are listening to the show or watching us. There is a difference between the engineering simulator at a manufacturer like Boeing and the pilot simulator that a pilot would get into when they go to a training center to fly. There is a big difference. And that difference has to do with the fidelity of the data. When I did Silk Air, we didn't get into a pilot simulator to try and understand the motion of the airplane based on the radar data. We got into an engineering simulator because it has more freedom of motion. It has better fidelity for us to dissect because they don't program in all of these wild parameters into a pilot training simulator. So like you were talking about, John, you can't just separate and take these little factoids and then be critical of us without having done your research. We don't mind the criticism. We appreciate people's point of view and opinions and that kind of thing, because yeah, sometimes we do miss things or we don't talk about it, or we may have taken it out of context. But, you know, again, you have to be sure that you've researched it like we've researched it to know about these things, so that if you want to be critical, great, because I want to learn from someone else's criticism. But if it's just going to be in attack mode and say, well, you always blame the pilot. I don't always blame. Last thing I want to do is blame a pilot, because I'm a pilot. But if the facts support that the pilot decision-making operation, or they lacked operational discipline, or they didn't understand what they were doing, if the facts support that, I'm sure as hell I'm not going to protect them either.
Yes, just the facts, ma'am. The facts.
And you know, you're the same way with maintenance folks. We are not infallible. And the fact is that that's what being an accident investigator is all about, is taking all those facts and putting those facts into context as they relate to the specific event. Not all the airy-fairy stuff. I challenge anybody out there to tell me how this, quote, love-in between the FAA and Boeing had a physical contribution to the accident in Lion Air or Ethiopia. Because when you look at the facts, the physical facts, the captain on Lion Air 610 had the airplane flying for 13 minutes. It was the last 52 seconds that killed him, when the first officer was flying, and he was flying and not doing the things that the captain had been doing to keep the airplane flying for 13 minutes. So you tell me, I understand all those issues, and those issues are a concern. And oh, by the way, they aren't just happening here in the United States. There are issues, there are shadow issues, there are backstories that are going on with every aircraft manufacturer and every regulation or regulatory authority out there. It's just that if they don't culminate in an accident and a lot of attention isn't brought to them, then of course they will just hover in that background until something bad happens. And we've seen a number of close calls and instances with composite materials on the A350. We're looking at it. You're looking at it in really depth with Pratt & Whitney and the Pratt & Whitney issue on 777s and things like that. So, you know, the sexy story, yeah, is sexy. And yeah, it sells newspapers, if you will, and it's got to fill the airtime. But In order to enhance aviation safety, you have to look at the facts. You have to look at what actually happened and put them in context. Ethiopian Airlines, those two pilots had these quote new procedures, which were really a reiteration of old procedures that came out of the Indonesian accident. And in fact, they followed part of those procedures and the airplane was flyable. But then those guys, after they turned off the stab trim switches, turned them back on. There's nothing in the procedure to tell you to do that. And as soon as they did that, MCAS starts firing. They never pulled the power back like you mentioned to me earlier. I mean, they're still blasting off at takeoff power. I mean, it's just a series of not only errors, it was errors and omissions on a flight crew that had no business really being in the front end of that airplane. And again, I'm a pilot. Last thing you want to do is blame a pilot. But when you have these kinds of mistakes from a trained flight crew, a professional flight crew flying for a airline that thinks that they're top shelf, I have problems with that.
You know, and you mentioned training a few times. I still haven't seen anybody in a position of power to talk about looking at the training syllabus between the U.S. carriers, European carriers, and other country carriers, South America.
Yep.
Because why didn't we have, or any of the other operators of the MAX have these problems? So there's something under there.
And you bring up a good point, John, and that is, if I was doing an axe investigation that's going to have an effect in the fleet around the world, I would have done just that. You got enough investigators. You put somebody on there, you create a team, and you go, I want you to call all of these MAX operators and find out what their training program is, who does it, how long it is, and then what they do with it.
What the syllabus is, right?
Yes.
What's in it?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, because we're making recommendations as the NTSB that affect the fleet and they affect operators around the world. Just as if the French were doing an investigation or the Brits or the Australians or anybody else, if there is something that's going to affect the fleet, then you should get at least a consensus around the world to make sure that you're not just doing, you know, your recommendation isn't just in isolation for a particular carrier, that it affects everybody who is operating that aircraft.
So we had a number of people, a number, three or four people that comment along the general lines of Boeing has made so many successful airplanes, they can't believe that the MAX would be where it is today. But we've talked about that repeatedly when we talked about Boeing and the changes that came after McDonnell Douglas took them over. The 777 was designed and certified before the merger with McDonnell Douglas. The 787 and the MAX were products of post-merger. And both of those have suffered a considerable pain in their operation because of the procedures that they put in place for McDonnell Douglas. Most people don't know that many Boeing employees were so fed up with the McDonnell Douglas management that came in that they quit, including Alan Mahaly, who was going to be the next president of Boeing. And he quit. And he went to Ford. And I know personally, at least a half a dozen people, engineers, that have left Boeing because of that merger. They just were frustrated trying to deal with the issues that were coming up and the management stonewalling it. And now they got their comings down, even though they walked away with a bundle of money, most of them. That's unfortunate, but that's above my pay grade. I hope Boeing gets back on track. They've gotten rid of some of the senior management, the highest level McDonnell Douglas people, but I'm sure there's still quite a few in the middle someplace.
And of course, we've seen this in other examples. We've seen it with other manufacturers. I saw a lot of this when I was doing the ATR 72 accident in Roselawn, Indiana. and some of the games that were being played. Okay, I understand that. We understand that. And yes, it is an issue that needs to be addressed. But when we're looking at these kinds of events and we're looking at the sequence of events to at least help our audience who is listening understand what it is an investigator or a team of investigators is going to look at, these are the issues. There are multitudes of issues out there that happen every single day. And it is dependent on the investigative authority to broaden their scope, especially if there's some sort of systemic problem. Like you were talking about, John, the fact that, you know, Boeing has been successful in certifying these airplanes in the past, just like Airbus, just like Embraer, just like a lot of these other manufacturers have been very successful despite some of the issues that come out as the result of an accident. The fact is that these growing pains, and as Jeffrey talked about on the show, the 737 MAX, everybody, you know, got the facts wrong again because it wasn't a sexy story. They said all they were, Boeing was in a race with Airbus because Airbus was getting the A320neo out there and it was going to be the best airplane and it was going to take over the market and everything else. And they rushed the 737 MAX into production. Guess what? They didn't. This was one of the longest, if not the longest, certification processes for this derivative of the 737. It was over 5 years. And so, again, if you're going to talk and you're going to make statements and have opinions, that's great, but you better have the facts correct. And unfortunately, the media played up on this because somebody said, oh my God, there was this race, you know, and they were racing Airbus to get to the airlines. Well, apparently they weren't racing fast enough because it took them 5 years to get the airplane certified. And on top of it, they did have issues with the engines as well. So again, I mean, there is always a backstory, but you got to have the facts of the backstory. You know, the street talk, yeah, it may sell papers for a while, just like the sexy story that, you know, Boeing was self-certifying the airplane. Guess what? If you want to use that type of mentality, then every manufacturer out there is self-certified because the FAA gives aircraft manufacturers and component manufacturers the ability to have in-house certification through DERs, designated engineering representatives, airworthiness representatives, manufacturing representatives, who work on behalf of the FAA, but paid by the manufacturer. And so there is still accountability there. It still has to go through a formal FAA process. It isn't that they can just stroke the pen and go, hey, we're good to go. And so again, you have to understand it. And that's what we try to be, that's what we've been trying to do with this. And we, again, we don't mind the criticism. We don't mind the opinions, but what we want to do is make sure that if we're going to learn something new, it's based on fact.
Keeps us on our toes as well.
Yep. Absolutely.
We got a couple of comments from a few people about how come our information is not picked up by the media coverage and the rest. Well, part of the reason why you don't see us on TV as much as you used to, because we've made so much noise with the producers of those TV programs that they don't want to hear us.
Yeah.
And that goes to Congress too, because the two of us spent a number of days talking to congressional staffers, laying out the facts and circumstances for the MAX accident. And none of it, zero, was used because it didn't fit the narrative that they wanted to.
That's right. They selectively filtered it, and it wasn't sexy. That's why they got Sullenberger and a few other people we know up there, because they'll parrot anything somebody wants them to parrot. And I can back that up with facts. So if somebody wants to be critical of me, fine, let them be critical. But I can show on multiple occasions where somebody has made a statement that is not based on fact. It is the twisting or manipulation of the facts to support someone else's narrative. That's why you and I don't spend a lot of time on TV anymore, because people don't want to hear the factual narrative because that's not sexy. And I talked ad nauseum about that in the first few shows that we ever did with regard to, we don't talk sexy. We talk facts. It's black and white. Here it is. And this is the bottom line, because that's what aviation and aviation safety is all about. It is not building a narrative so that somebody, I mean, how many books did Jeffrey say there were? Well over 100 books on MH370, none of which are fact-based, because all of those books that have at least a prophecy of what the going theory is on what caused that event to occur and the outcome of the airplane is not based on any facts. I don't know how many people said it was an in-flight fire. You show me the evidence that it was an in-flight fire. How many people have said that it was, of course, a bomb or something else? Show me the evidence. The highest probability is, of course, based on fact, as we know it today, that it was an intentional act. And while some of the information is circumstantial, it supports the narrative better than an in-flight fire. How are you going to have an in-flight fire on an airplane that burns for 7 hours and doesn't burn that airplane out of the sky well before that? It makes no sense. Oh, there was electrical malfunction that caused the airplane to crash. Airplanes don't fly for 7 hours if you've got electrical malfunction that's going to take out an autopilot or pilots or anybody. There are so many different narratives, but people made some money selling their interpretation of factoids. So, well, John, I know we got to wrap this show up. You and I had the opportunity to be in Nashville. We talked to a very large maintenance organization who I really like what they do. They bring in customers as part of their advisory board so that they can get real-time feedback from actual customers as to what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, where they can improve, and things like that. And we had the opportunity to sit through that and then present for 3 hours. Some of the facts that we understand from a variety of different types of accidents, maintenance-related accidents, operations-related accidents, and everything in between. And we always appreciate these opportunities because we try to give back this knowledge and information. We've gotten a lot of feedback from the folks in attendance there, including the host. I just received a text about the fact that we were a big hit. We don't do these to be a big hit. We do these, to be educators and to pass or at least give back into the industry what we know, what we've learned, so that they can use this in their own respective organizations or operations to enhance their safety and of course, enhance aviation safety overall. So I've sent some information back to them, and I look for more. Maintenance organizations, flight departments, everybody else, reach out to us, because John and I, this is our give back. This is the way we do it besides this particular show. And we'll be happy to come in and give you what we know. We use case studies, examples, and that kind of thing, things that you're never going to read about in a report. And so,
and tailor them to their operation.
Yep.
If they're a Learjet operation, we'll focus in on all the Learjet issues.
Yeah.
You got two or three types, we'll do two or three types. I mean, we just did another, we did the one in Phoenix too, just 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, to a very large flight department that's spread out all over the country. So, those are unique issues because you have a lot of folks that are operating an airplane that do belong to the flight department, but they're running their particular operation autonomously. They don't have the type of oversight that if everybody was coming back to home base every night, because these airplanes aren't. So there are unique things that we try to bring out based on accidents and incidents that we've seen in the past to hopefully help them improve their particular flight operation, their oversight, their accountability, so that they don't have a serious incident or accident. Well, John, we've come to another end or conclusion, temporary conclusion of a flight safety detective episode. And of course, I've shot off my mouth enough during this show. So as I always do, I will leave you with our last words.
I'm going to add a little bit to the last word this week, because in looking through some of the accidents of recent past, there's a number of accidents that involve student pilots renting airplanes and student with instructors.
that have damaged and in some cases totaled the airplane. And if you're out there flying as a student or taking lessons, please get yourself an insurance policy. I'm told that these policies are like $95 for some of the basic policies. They're not, I mean, it's less than an hour's flight time, and you're going to protect yourself. So rule one, if you're a student or renting an airplane, protect yourself with your own insurance policy. Two, if you are going flying, do a thorough pre-planning session. Remember, it's not the weather in the beginning and the end, it's the weather in the middle as well. In fact, they've been Todd is off doing his cross country today, and I hope he does well on that. The weather has been a little bit iffy around here. And when you get out to your airplane, do a very thorough pre-flight. You know, touch your airplane. If you don't know what you're looking for, find a mechanic that works on the airplane and ask him. And after you take off, please, please put your head on a swivel and keep your eyes open. Look for traffic. I mean, we've got those traffic accidents coming back again. Some near misses and a few collisions. So please don't, make it a real accident. Don't make it something dumb.
Make it a real accident. Don't encourage people to have accidents.
If you're going
to
have an accident, don't have a stupid one.
We don't want anybody who's listening to us or subscribing to us to have an accident.
True. True. But it's painful to have the stupid ones.
Yeah, well.
Totally avoidable because you've done, you're not paying attention. You're not, head's not in the cockpit. So yeah. That's what I meant. That's what I meant. Don't, if you go flying, focus on your flying, nothing else.
Yeah, John, that's why I keep you around. You are always good for some entertainment.
Okay. So please fly safely, everybody.
To listen or watch more episodes of this show, go to FlightSafetyDetectives.com, the Flight Safety Detectives YouTube channel, or your favorite place to listen to podcasts. To contact John and Greg about the show, send them an email at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And remember, for aviation insurance needs, contact Avemco Insurance at avemco.com or give them a call at 888-879-0389. Mention Flight Safety Detectives and receive a 5% discount. Thanks for listening to the Flight Safety Detectives, and remember to always fly safe.